be ready to start. We're going to be wrapping up chapter 8 and 9. Lesson 9, which is chapter 10, will be beginning this evening. And a reminder, if you have not got them, there is questions back there on that table for chapter 11. We got it in two parts, 11.1, 11.2. We cover the first section of the memorial of the Lord's Supper, and then the second with the head covering. And I've been waiting to do the questions for 12 through 14. I'm going to group those together. Lord willing, by Sunday you'll have those. So we'll be progressing along nicely, hopefully. But this evening we're going to be finishing up chapter 8 and 9 and working our way into chapter 10. At least that's the plan for this evening. All right. Before we begin, I want to have a prayer. Brother Jerry Williams, if you will you lead us in prayer, please? Amen. All right, we had finished up last week talking in question number 7, 8, I guess, about the teacher. We started up with the ideal of the reality of verses 12 through 13 about our liberties. Remember, they're subject to our spiritual welfare and the welfare of others, especially our brethren. We're not done with that theme. We're going to see this in chapter 10. In fact, everything we've studied in chapter 8 and 9 is also inclusive to chapter 10. He just expands on the discussion. And to be quite frank with you, he goes beyond liberty. And he teaches us lessons even besides our liberty that are just so fundamental by chapter 10. And we'll get to that in just a little bit. But keep that in mind. But there is a lesson for us, for those that are teachers, teaching for the teachers, if you will. And you find that in 9 through 11. You find that in chapter verse 12, 15, 16. All of these, of course, found in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Of course, teachers have a right for support, don't they? Preachers, teachers. He will use the example of what? David, what example does he use? Right. Yeah. There is a beast of burden that you intend to use in order to plant your crop that you make for your livelihood. Are you going to starve that animal? You'll be foolish, foolhardy. And a person that says, well, I'm going to get every ounce of energy that I can get out of that beast, but I'm not feeding that beast. They're going to tell you, you are a foolish farmer. You will not have productivity because eventually that beast will not plow for you. Paul makes a statement very abundantly clear for us. That is that we will feed the animal that will take care of our livelihood, and you will feed that animal well enough for you to get your work. Sometimes animals get fed better than people, so, right? Well, the fact is that using that as an illustration, Paul says it goes beyond the right or the privileges. It goes to the very fundamental of what is in your best interest. A lot of preachers don't talk about that because, you know, again, for various reasons. It is true, he's saying, that you're going to feed the animal. They have a right to eat. Therefore, the preacher has a right for support. But Paul is subtly teaching them it's for your welfare. It's for your benefit. That you will gain something spiritually from that, just as you gain something physically or temporally from that animal that produces or plows your field. Keep that in mind. But though a preacher or a teacher has a right for support and it would be to your best benefit, sometimes brethren don't think that away, do they? And the wise man, especially the one who is the teacher, may decide to do what? Not receive support. say, you know, it is not in your interest. Now, I'm not giving you a reason not to support me, but I am telling you, as Paul teaches.
Well, a preacher at court where I grew up, Ed Britt had his own business. He had Gateway Clinic. And Ed never took a dollar.
Right, right.
He supported himself. And,
right, and there's some that do that. Right. Some do. I've heard of some. I've known some, as you know some. Paul is doing this even beyond, if you think about, and it is true, I'm not arguing that we can't use that application. If I have the ability to help and the church is interested in me and teaching the gospel, but I also have a job in which supports my family, to be quite frank with you, from my perspective, if that was the case, then I would say we need to be supporting preachers that are in other places. And that I don't receive support here, or what have you. That is not a bad plan at all, because we're still doing the Lord's work. But isn't the money still going to support the preachers, correct? Yeah, and that's a good thing. So in some cases, you'll find churches that do that. Paul is giving us one of those situations where he may not always be in the best of situation. He doesn't say that specifically. It appears that he at least is able to supply his needs in the tent-making profession. Go back to chapter 18 of Acts. That's what is referenced here. In Acts chapter 18, he, of course, with Priscilla and Aquila that are in the same business, they make their living making tents. Tents are necessary for those who are traveling in those days, and it's more advantageous and more safe than the inns, by the way. With the right number of people and the protection, you and you're out on the open road, these tents would supply the need of the merchants and the travelers, and so that would be the way to go. And so they were providing a service and a product, and probably doing well with it. But even if he weren't, as Paul tells us in Philippians 4, there were many occasions in which he did abase, not just abound. And if that were the case, he still, in his argument, would not receive support from Corinth. Remember, his not receiving support from Corinth was not based on his need or lack thereof. Like in the case that Joe or I know or somebody else knows, it may be that I choose not to because I'm doing another job and I'm able to help here, and that's fine and dandy. But aside from that, Paul never makes the argument I was working, so therefore I didn't take money from you. No, what was his argument about not receiving support from Corinth? Right, well, actually it doesn't say that explicitly. Now, what you learn in the Corinth later on is they were using that as evidence that he's not an apostle. Hey, he can't be an apostle because he's not receiving support from us. And maybe they've seen other apostles come in because it doesn't say who has been through the area. They may have heard by word of mouth other apostles receiving support from other places. Maybe they even knew for fact of Paul's support from other places. And they're going to say that really you're not a legitimate apostle because if you were, you would receive support from us. But we would have to speculate as to why. Because he doesn't say. He doesn't say in Acts 18. He doesn't say here in the letter to the 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians. There are hints that there are challenges, that Paul understands things that we don't know, but we don't have to know. He would not receive support from them. Maybe because, and we're using the maybes because we don't know, that in the case of David's argument that some would charge some things against him for whatever reason. Maybe because of the divisiveness and the challenges within the congregation, that some churches are such contentious groups of people, you don't need to add anything that's going to cause any more problems than there already, right? And this could be one of those things. I want to make it clear, Paul's not doing this because I've got a job, as we've talked about. But he's doing this because it ain't going to be good for them. He's waited, and his wisdom says, I don't receive support from you because I don't see what it's going to help you spiritually. I see it's going to be a hindrance. Do we know what that is? Nope. Do we have some ideals? Possibly. But we know this much. Whatever it takes to preach the gospel without causing more problems, that's what Paul's going to do. That's what we need to learn. All right. So, of course, we can make the application, as we've already learned, that the preacher has a right to support, but it's not always to the benefit of the congregation. That the preacher, maybe in wisdom, will not receive support. And by the way, because he made tents in Corinth and did not take support from them, does that mean he did not receive support from anyone else? We don't know. We know it's possible. We know that while he's in prison, that the churches of Macedonia and Philippi would help out. We know that they were very generous in his help in different times, in different places. That even when he was not among them, that they would support him at other places. That he may receive supports from all kinds of churches, including Ephesus, by the way. But for whatever reason, Corinth was not. When I said Macedonia, save Corinth. Maybe, for instance, the church at Philippi, which I've already mentioned. The churches of Achaia, he may have received. Any of those, because they're broken up in regions. They're in that place we call Greece nowadays. But there's Macedonia to the north. There's Achaia in the middle. And then there is Greece, technically, to the south, according to the division. All we know is that there were going to be trouble if he did. He realized it. He said it was not worth it. He discovers it wasn't, but they're still going to use it against him, as we've already noted. And they're going to say, well, you're not an apostle. Well, he's going to prove them wrong in that regard. What is to be our attitude in Christ, verse 19? What is to be our attitude? Notice in verse 19. For though I am free, NSAB this evening, for though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, so that I may win more. How would you sum that up in your own words? Okay. Maybe. Yeah, self-restraint. I don't know that I would say necessarily, David, loving one less than someone else. Because really giving honor in the terms that Christ has laid before us and offering our bodies as a living sacrifice doesn't mean we necessarily love ourselves less. But in the process of loving and taking care of oneself, you're going to be caring for another. I think that's really the key. Because somebody could carry that to an extreme in which you deprive yourself so much that you really put yourself in harm and detriment in a situation that will make you unable to help another. So that will be foolish, wouldn't it? You know, if I give you everything that I have and have nothing to provide for myself, what am I going to do in the future after I'm done giving to you? You see? So Paul's not arguing about a literal emptying of everything and giving up of oneself completely. It's a living sacrifice attitude that says that within the context of everything that I have to offer you, and particularly spiritually in his case, I'm going to give it all. I'm going to lay it all before you. I'm going to make sure that you benefit. That's what he's saying, because he talks about as the slave, that is, that I'm going to become your slave for your need. One of the other important things to remember is that really if you translate that according to some of the Old Testament passages, it would be the ideal of directing our footsteps no longer. Proverbs 3, verse 6. Paul says in verse 5 that we are to trust in the Lord with all our might and lean not on our own understanding. Verse 6 he says, not to direct our steps, not to direct our own path. In other words, we don't decide from our own will and desire our own movements. Our will is directed by him. That's Proverbs 3. Psalms 119, verse 133 tells us the same thing, that we don't direct our own steps. And then ultimately, that will lead to us, as God has directed us, as we see the benefit it will be for others, that we are no longer concerned primarily with ourselves. Because in order to become a living sacrifice, if you gave up completely anything that you have, in other words, don't give any concern at all for yourself, how long will you last as a living sacrifice? You become a dead sacrifice. You see my point. Now, that's not to say that there won't be an occasion through our work with persecution, etc., that we will lose our lives and that we will become so deprived that we will end up not having anything to offer. I'm not arguing that you won't, but you understand that you need resources, just like Paul. Did Paul go to Corinth and say, well, I'm not going to receive money from them because I know that it's not going to benefit them spiritually, but I'm not going to provide for myself while I'm teaching them? How long do you think you will live? He spent 18 months with them. Can you go without eating for 18 months? That's right. At least on that second occasion. The first occasion, he might not have been there as long. But on the second occasion, he was there 18 months. The two churches in the New Testament that we have described very explicitly of Paul's lengthy stay are the church at Corinth and the church at Ephesus. Both Acts 18. And he also tells us in Galatians, not in Acts 19. But in Acts 18, he spends 18 months at Corinth. And in Ephesus, he spends 3 years. A man's not going to go without eating. So providing for oneself doesn't mean you don't do anything for yourself, but you become a living sacrifice. I humiliate myself in the context of saving souls. I use that word very carefully, but understand, it is a humiliation of oneself, but that's what God's called us to. Didn't he humiliate himself? Philippians 2 says, Jesus says, he humbled himself. We don't usually think of humble and humiliate. We almost think of them as two different words, don't we? Humble's a nice word. Oh, you're an humble guy. Oh, you were humiliated. You see how you use it negatively and use it positive? But they're the same word. It depends on how you are using the word as to how what it means. And in this case, it is a positive thing. I humiliate myself. Jesus humiliated himself. He didn't need to, but he wanted to. God wanted to for our benefit, as he goes on to say in Philippians chapter 2. If I don't humble myself in that way, then I will lose. I will lose the greatest and precious gift I can have. And what is the precious, most precious gift that I have? My soul. What's the most precious gift that you have? That's right. And that's why it's not confusing when we look at the New Testament and we describe, for instance, in Galatians, on the one hand, I bear your load, your burden. But then Paul turns around in the same context in verse 5 of Galatians 6 and says, but each one bears his own load. Well, which is it, Paul? It's both. Now, that defies human reason. It doesn't make any sense to the way we conduct ourselves as far as this world affairs are concerned without any regard to our spiritual welfare. But when you put your spiritual welfare in context and you understand the nature of God and what he did for us and what we need to do for one another, then you understand it well. I bear my load, you bear your load. You concern for your soul, you're concerned for my soul. Ultimately, you will give an account for your soul, I'll give an account for mine. I do not have to answer for yours, but you do. I don't have to answer for yours, you don't have to answer for mine, but I do answer for how I conduct myself toward you in accordance to God's will. So in one way, I do hold an account for you. Why do we sing the song, you never mentioned him to me, if we're not accountable? But ultimately, you have to respond to that. And if you choose not to, I'm not responsible. I've done what I've been told. You see how it works? So again, remember that for those of you who have studied with the Revelation, we'll do that here sometime. Here he will discuss with us this serving, this sacrifice. And I want to remind you again, this crown. Your Bibles, most of the translations you use may use the word crown when it talks about that word for wreath. Maybe you have a translation that uses the word wreath. There are also old translations that use the word diadem, and that's a type of crown, but they're two different things. What we're describing here is we're describing one that will receive the victory crown. That is that Stephanos, as the Greek says. It is the wreath. It is the one that is wrapped around, that has the flowers or the leaves upon it, that has been put upon the head of the victory general, the one who's went to battle and has won. It sets on the white horse, oftentimes done in response to the generals that came back from great battles. Sometimes they were Caesars, like Caesar, Julius, and Pompey and others like them. Or it was described to illustrate the one who won the races, the games that were played, the precursor to our Olympic Games, the original Olympics, as the Greeks and the Romans would practice. So we are playing, we're in a race, as Paul says. us. That's what he's describing verses 20 through 27. You know what? His audience has that in mind. They recognize that. And by the way, while we're on this, Sunday morning, we're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk about the elements surrounding the text there in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, more in chapter 9 in particular. Chapter 9, so that's what we'll be. We are at chapter 8. But keep that in mind. So we become slaves. We're runners. We run with all of our might like we will lose if we don't run as fast and as enduring as we can, just to continue to fight, continue to race. That's another way of putting it. Our bodies don't give up. We won't be lazy. We won't be slothful. We won't be neglectful. That's what Paul is stressing in verses 20 through 27 of 1 Corinthians 9. All right? Three lessons from chapter 8 and 9. What's the first thing we see primarily in chapter 8? What's the first verse say? Okay. You were saying it, I think, sister. That's right. So, another way of putting that, knowledge, though it is important, and I'd say vastly important, because if I don't know what to do well or right, then I'm going to do what is not right and not well, and it's not going to help me. But, even that, though that is the case, as Sister Ruth has said, it's important that we understand the place for love, because without love we'll be condemned. Knowledge cannot work by itself. Now, I made this clear. I stressed this, I think, last time on Sunday. I don't believe necessarily it's knowledge plus love. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm just trying to describe and illustrate it. But I like to view it more like this. That what it is that love is the motivator, the engine behind knowledge. The what I know will motivate me to do what I'm supposed to do. You think about that. Knowledge by itself is only knowledge. It's information. You know something, but that doesn't mean you act upon it. But if you understand the totality of New Testament Christianity as God has expressed it through His Son, as we read in the Gospel, then what you're left with was one conclusion. The more I know motivates me to do what I should. And to what I do will be in the act of love. When you see the first century Christians, and to illustrate this, in Acts chapter 2, verse 46. Verse 42, they're keeping steadfast to the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking bread. And so they're doing all the spiritual activity that they should be doing. But he says in verse 46, besides the spiritual, which he does talk about, going to the temple daily, he's talking about praying, but he also adds one other element they also do. They come together from into one another's houses. So there's the social component. But notice what they do in every one of these instances in verse 46. It's together. You see that? So why do you think I stress the importance of what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 10:25, as we talked about a few weeks ago? That to assemble together, as we are told, waiting for that great resurrection day, looking earnestly for it, is to stir one another up to love and good works. Hebrews 10, verse 24. Correct? So, think about that. Knowledge, though vastly important, will condemn us without love. Secondly, what did I talk about Sunday? The difference in verse 3. The difference in the kind of knowledge we're dealing with. What does it say again in verse 3 of chapter 8? Okay, so what am I stressing then? God knows me. If I love Him, God knows me. He's not saying I know God. He says that in another place, doesn't he? That to keep His commandments, as the letter of 1 John tells us in 1 John chapter 4, he says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Actually, 1 John 5:3 says that, but he also stresses it in 1 John chapter 4. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. So then he goes on to chapter 4 and says that I know Him if I keep His commandments. But that's not what Paul says here. Paul says that I'm known by Him, and that's much more intimate of a thought. Because on the one hand, I get to know him because I listen to him and I do what he says because I know him and I love him. That just shows everything that I do in order to get in connection with him. But it says here that he knows me. And remember what I said about the king knowing me. Does kings know everybody always in every empire? None. No president knows everybody. You still only know the people you know, even if that circle is much larger than the little peon, as we would say, in that little remote part of the world. You still have only that knowledge, however large that sphere is. But it says very plainly that he knows me. And that means not just that he knows who I am, he knows me in a very personal or intimate way. And number three, 1 Corinthians 9, I'll sum up this way. I subject myself to others in order to win all to Christ. Now that's a tall order. That'll be our lesson on Sunday morning. Maybe that'll be the good title for it. I subject myself to all in order to win all to Christ. Or I subject myself to others to win all to Christ. All right? Chapter 10. Lesson 9, according. What did Paul not want the Corinthians to be unaware of? Benjamin? What did Paul not want the Corinthians to be unaware of? Unaware or ignorant. I don't know what translation you may use. I noticed because I was reading out of the ASV this afternoon, because I move around in some of my studies and readings, as I was noticing they use the word ignorant and not unaware. It's the same point. To be ignorant is to not know, right? We use that in negative terms, but really, legitimately, we're all ignorant of something, right? Because we don't know everything. We're all finite. There's plenty I'm ignorant of, and that's not a bad thing. It can't be a bad thing if there's something I'm supposed to be knowing and I'm ignorant and I choose to be. But I am unaware. I'm ignorant. What is he talking about, Ben? It's in verse 1. Now, look at the great context. When he opens up the chapter there in chapter 10, and he talks about my relationship with Moses, and I said chapter 9, actually, I haven't decided, but we may be looking at chapter 10. I'm waffling between the two in Sunday morning's preaching, not necessarily a lesson. Think about it. My relationship with God, as he describes, is through Moses. He says, They had Christ through Moses, didn't they? Have you noticed that? That the one that led them. Now, he's not talking about the particular elements, the constituent parts, like the rock that on one occasion he was told to strike, and he did. The other occasion he was told to speak, and he striked, and he wasn't supposed to, was he? He striked. And he didn't. But either way, those constituent, he says, well, that was the rock. Well, it was a representation. That rock wasn't literally Christ, but it represented. But the same thing when he talks about, and they were following Christ, as he talks about in our context. Well, remember they had the cloud by day and the fiery pillar by night. The fiery pillar sat with them at night as a guard while they stayed and rested. When they traveled by day, that cloud moved with them, and that cloud was over them during the day when they sat. Remember, they sat at the foot of Mount Sinai for over a year. They arrived there 3 months in by Exodus 19. They spent a whole year there at the foot of Sinai. Of course, they got in trouble there too, didn't they, before they moved on. But that cloud was there. By the way, go to Exodus 34 and you learn, guess what? That cloud sat over the tabernacle meeting. And where was that tabernacle of meeting? Does anybody know? Outside. He didn't sit with them. You know what? They stood in their doorways. This is after the golden calf scene and the striking and the having to look upon the bronze serpent and so on and so forth. And I think 24,000 or so died on the occasion, maybe 30. That one of the two. It's more than one occasion. 24,000 died later on with the Moabites, but at any rate.
Is that the way to answer the question?
No, it's about relationship. It is true in their specific case that they had the cloud, they had the fiery pillar, but the answer is the relationship. What they didn't appreciate is they had God with them.
It was an act of obedience because they were told to do it, and they had to do it. If they hadn't, they would have...
Oh, it's beyond that. It's beyond obedience, because we can do something because we're compelled to. I can obey because you got the force to cause me. You stick a gun to my head, I will do anything you say. God's not doing that, of course. We know that, right? And it's true, obedience is demanded. I'm not arguing against those sorts of things, but we're missing it if we think it's about obedience. It's about relationship. Remember what's the whole context in chapter 8, 9, and 10. If I were to take 8 through 10 and I would put it in one basket and say, what am I going to learn about these three chapters? I have, and I'll distress that later on at the end of it. I got liberty in Christ, but my liberty is in subjection to my relationship in Christ. And my subjection in relationship to Christ, it means that I'm subject to you and you to me. And that I understand and respect that, and I don't get on my haunches and say, my will be done. That's the difference. You see my point? That what he's trying to tell us in the first part of chapter 10 is this, that we understand and respect our relationship. He tells them, don't be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud. He's saying you were privileged. He's saying you were under the... You know what he's saying? You're with God. To be under the cloud meant God was there. Okay? He's under the cloud and passed through the sea. What's passing through the sea? Remember, he talks about the sea. What is he talking about when he says passes through the sea? Red Sea, correct? All right. If he passes through the Red Sea, what does that mean? That's right. And he doesn't drown in it. He's saved. Who didn't pass through the sea? Right, right. The soldier. Pharaoh and his army did not pass through. Did they not die in the sea? They did. Who passed through the sea? God's people. Who was under the cloud? God's people. You see how he's describing it? Who was with them? It's beyond obedience. It's the ideal of a relationship. Who was with them? God was with them. Now, he doesn't just say God. Look how he goes on with it. He says, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea. So he extends that out and he uses the word immersion or baptism. And he makes the connection here. He uses what he's already described, the sea and the cloud. He says they were baptized in it, immersed in it. Really, if you think about it, they were immersed twice. In essence, the way it's being used. Well, the two times that they passed through water. Yeah, coming out and going in. Notice the relationship of coming in. Now you see how the types don't have to mean reality. The types are the types. They don't correspond literally with New Testament examples in every way. That they're only illustrative. That we use water and we understand that. We use immersion, we understand that. We understand the passing through. But notice there, it wasn't just getting out of. It was going into. Right. Right, right. If you use that other illustration, you're right. As Brother Leon's pointed out, the one is the salvation, the other was the promise. Because the Hebrew writer says that, but he uses it correspondingly. He says, really, didn't they miss out on the rest? The Hebrews chapter 3 and 4 context says they missed out on the rest. They sure did. Because that first generation, as we're going to just learn, they died in the wilderness, didn't they? They didn't get in there. Like I said, we'll talk more about that because I am going to look, and I've decided 1 Corinthians 10 will be Sunday morning's lesson. You're going to see that in more vivid picture. We need to look at that, okay? Right. That's right. Well, that's right. Even what they knew, it goes back to knowledge. I'm glad you brought it up. You said you were the word appreciate. Well, yeah, that's true. Right. 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 That's true. But they had knowledge, correct? And so we know they knew exactly what the occasion called. But what they didn't appreciate, and I like the word appreciate, they didn't recognize in a deep and an abiding way the importance of that. How how it wasn't just that they did this and God was with them, but that God cared for them and nurtured them through that wilderness. Yep, and those who did recognize that, we need to make sure the whole did not, but those that did appreciate. Did Moses not appreciate? Did Joshua not appreciate? I go back to Exodus 34 real quick. They ever sinned against God. Now they are remorseful, those who survived. And the picture is painted before us in Exodus 34. They are standing outside their tents, standing at the doorways of their tents, it says. And I could just see the scene. Because this is a squared camp. It's not a circular. They've got them divided by tribes on each side. Maybe you've seen the pictures of them in the maps, etc. And in the middle of it is the tabernacle. Well, they were in the midst of already getting all that together, but they didn't have that yet. You see, by Genesis 34, you don't see that. Remember what happened? Moses goes up, he gets the law. Part of the law was the building of the tabernacle, right? So they don't have that yet. So this camp is not necessarily like that. What's in the midst of them? What was before the sin of Exodus 32? What was in the midst? If it wasn't the tabernacle, nope, that was built later. I know that. But what was in the midst of them that was removed? The tabernacle of meeting. We have to look at that. Read that in Exodus 34. The tabernacle. What was the tabernacle of meeting? Well, that's just the same thing as the tabernacle. And that's where the Ark of the Covenant resided. That's where the sacrifices were. But the problem with that was this was a tabernacle or a tent that predated the construction of the temple or the tabernacle that they used for service, that the priests were accountable in their service. Notice in verse 34. Now, God gives all of this to them, but nothing gets built until after. I think it's chapter 34. The two tablets are going to be replaced. God's going to renew this. Let's see. Okay, no, back up to 33. I said 34. Notice in verse 7 of chapter 33. Now, Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, a good distance from the camp. And I'm using the New American, so it uses the word tent. Maybe yours says tabernacle. Does it say that? New King James, King James, tabernacle. Same thing. Okay, same thing. Tabernacle, whatever. Tent. And he pitched it outside the camp, a good distance from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. And it came about whenever Moses went out to the tent that all the people would rise and stand each at the entrance of his tent and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent. And whenever Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. When all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would arise and worship each at the entrance of his tent. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Friends, this tent of meeting was intended to be inside the camp. But what prevented it from being there? Their idolatry, their sin. You reject God, God's got to move away from you. There is a time of cleansing as the ideal. There's the anger of the Lord, then there's the anger of Moses after what he sees that God already knows. And that's what's described for us in Exodus 33. So here it is in chapter 10 again, that this baptism, this immersion's in the cloud and in the sea. When did that happen in the cloud? Well, it happened when they went out to worship and God spoke to Moses at his tent, at the tent that he's designed or selected, as we saw. And they would be immersed, you see. And they ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink. Obviously, they had manna, which God had given them, which was some edible food, but it was spiritual because it was God that gave it to them. It wasn't something that grew out of the wilderness or some wild game that was in the wilderness. Those things were brought. Even the quail that was brought to them was not a bevy of quail that made passages across the desert. It was given to them miraculously. Quail don't arrive in Sinai. All right? And they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them. The rock followed them. So we know it can't be just the rock, literally. But the spiritual rock, he says, is Christ. Notice how Christ is with them. We'll talk more about that, Lord willing, Sunday morning. We've only got into the first question anyway. So you'll get double dose Sunday. We'll be looking at this in the class in chapter 10. And Sunday morning, and then we'll have it as our lesson Sunday morning. Thank you for your kind attention.